I'm DeMelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. We're listening to a song from the Oregon Children's Theater production of Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. It's sung by Madeline Tran, who plays Min Lee.
Straight through the heart of the forest, then to the city of bright moonlight. Then when I find the guardian, ask him for a borrowed line. Min Lee, stop, stop, don't be so naive. Keep your head. You know well you shouldn't just believe what some goldfish said.
The musical was written by Min Khan and adapted from the Newbery-winning book by Grace Lin.
But she's heard of the old man of the moon, and she knew what to do to get to the never-ending peak. How would she know unless it's there? How was she so prepared to answer me? Wait. That goldfish could speak. And if goldfish can speak, then perhaps my fortune can be changed, and I must learn how. Ask the old man how it can be changed. Better not lose time. Better go right now.
The show runs through May 28th at the Newmark Theater in Portland. Get tickets at octc.org. And Grace Lin is coming to town on May 27th to see the show, and we'll have a book signing right after the 2 p.m. show hosted by OCT and Green Bean Books. And with me to talk about her many books, her career, and Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, and more, is author Grace Lin. Hey, Grace.
Hi.
So great to, you know, it really is wonderful to meet you. Like, we're not in the same room, but we will be. But it's really great to see you. And I just want to welcome you to Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. You know, it's also great to meet another Taiwanese American. Woohoo! Where are you located now? I'm just curious.
I live in Western Massachusetts, so about 2 hours away from Boston.
Is that where you pretty much grew up? Is that area?
No, I did not grow up in this area at all, actually. I grew up in upstate New York.
Oh.
And I'm always very careful to say upstate New York, or else people think I mean New York City, which is very, very diverse. And I did not grow up in a very diverse area. I grew up in upstate New York, which is about 6 hours away from New York City. And it was, like I said, not very diverse at all.
Yeah, people don't realize that there's this whole rural, small town aspect of New York when you get upstate. So, yeah, so there probably weren't very many Asians, like you said, in that area.
Yeah, not many. In fact, I was the only Asian girl in my elementary school, except for my sisters. So for a long time, I was the only Asian girl in my class year after year after year.
Yeah, I totally relate to that because I grew up in a small town outside of Eugene, Oregon, and it was the home of the Scandinavian Festival. So that can tell you, like, you know, I had a lot of descendants who were Scandinavian, and we were the only interracial family. So, you know, I could totally relate to being the only one, you know, in an area. And it really, you don't notice it too much until you get into an area where there are more Asians and more people, and you kind of compare notes. And then you also wonder, seeing yourself on television or seeing, you know, Asians on film, which was pretty rare as well. And when that happened, it was a pretty big deal, actually.
Yeah, it was extremely rare. I never saw anyone Asian in a book or in a magazine or in a movie when I was growing up at all. And so, you know, for a long time, I would kind of forget that I was Asian. I mean, I actually, honestly, it's not really forget. I purposely tried to forget that I was Asian. And so that was something that only once in a while would come back to bite me in ways that I wasn't, I didn't like amongst my peers. And then also when I was older, being amongst other Asians, like you said, it was just such a strange feeling to let go of that mask that you always wear, like a mask that you didn't even know you had.
Yeah, well, I, you know, being biracial, it was probably easier for me. And I had to really actively seek out letting people know that I was this undercover Asian, you know? and really inform people all the time. And that's like this whole other situation when you're mixed race. It's like, do I say something? Do I not? You know, so there's all these different things. But you're right. When you get to, especially when I get to meet other mixed race people, whether they're Asian or not, it really feels like, oh, so we're doing this code switching. And we really didn't know that we were doing it as much, you know, because you're just trying to fit in, you know, and you're trying to get opportunity and you're trying to, you know, make success in the world. So it sounds like, you know, the topic probably of some of the children's books you've written.
Definitely.
You know, about that whole aspect. I mean, you have written dozens and dozens of books. You've received the Newbery and the Caldecott Honor. You're a National Book Award finalist. I mean, how many books have you published? I lost count after about 20 or so.
I think it's kind of hard to say because some books I only wrote, some books I only illustrated, some books I wrote and illustrated. So I usually tell people I've written and illustrated over 30, depending on how you count it. But it's over 30, no matter how you count it.
Over 30 is something to be proud of. That's a heck of a lot. I understand you started writing books when you were a child.
Yes, I did. You know, I always loved books. I think it goes back to what we were saying about feeling like being the only one. And so I think since I felt this kind of strange sense of alienation, books became kind of my friends. And I loved books so much. And so whenever there was a school project, I always made a book. You know, when there was a project on the Vikings, I remember my friend Jill made a Viking helmet and my friend Charlotte made a Viking boat. But I made a book about the Vikings because I just loved making books so much. So yeah, I was making books all the way since like third or fourth grade.
That's amazing. And were your parents supportive of that?
Yes and no. I think they liked that I was enthusiastic about school, enthusiastic about, you know, writing and books in general. And being enthusiastic about books usually gets you pretty good praise from your teachers. And so my parents enjoyed that. But I think when they realized that I wanted to make it into a career as a job, I think it took them aback a bit. And I think it took them a little while to figure out what exactly I was trying to do.
Well, you know, I have to ask you this because so many Asian Americans can relate to that experience. Your parents are, you know, first generation immigrants from Taiwan, and they are respectively a doctor and a botanist, for goodness sakes. And so you come from a medical and science, you know, lineage. And I would imagine there was some, you know, not necessarily pressure, but maybe some expectations of going into a different field, perhaps?
Yes, I think they were not exactly happy when I said that I wanted to go to art school. But to give them great credit, even though they did not understand and they had a lot of pressure and a lot of almost shame from our relatives and other people in the Asian community. I mean, I remember very vividly Asian friends of my parents calling my mom up and saying, "How dare you let your daughter go to art school? I told my son it's medical school or nothing." And, you know, even with that kind of pressure and that kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, shame, they still allowed me to go to art school. That said, I was pretty stubborn. I was pretty stubborn. And I think they also knew that I had to make my own choice there. Otherwise, I would fail at the choice that they chose for me. So it was hard for them. I wouldn't say it was easy for any of us. But luckily for them, they have my older sister and my younger sister who were very academically brilliant. And my older sister became a scientist and now she's a professor at Skidmore College in chemistry. And my younger sister, I went to University of Chicago. So it was kind of like, I'm like, okay, that's fine. Isn't that enough? You got 2 out of 3.
Well, I'm sure now at this point, you know, that you're such an acclaimed writer. What book did it take for them to realize, oh, this is okay, you know, she can do this writing thing, you know?
you know, I think it took them a long time to really kind of understand what I was doing. But I think the book that changed their mind, well, I don't know if it changed their mind, but it changed their feeling of what I was doing. Like, I think before this book, there's always this kind of vague disapproval. But when I wrote the book, Dumpling Days, that was the book that kind of, I think, transformed their vague disapproval to something like, oh, this is actually something quite nice. You know, Dumpling Days is actually a very personal story about my family's trip to Taiwan. It's actually based on many trips that my family went to Taiwan to as when I was a child. But in the book, I call it my very first trip to Taiwan. And so it's all about an American-born Chinese person or a Taiwanese person going to Taiwan and feeling Taiwanese but American and that kind of mix and how they can love both. And so I think that was something that really moved them.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I'm also thinking, you know, that was a very personal book for you, but often you choose protagonists probably from a personal level because, you know, you don't often see yourselves in a book as an Asian American. You don't see yourself on stage or in films. And so it seems like it was really important for you to choose protagonists who were Asian characters.
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, if you look at my whole, collection of books that I've created, I mean, they're pretty much all Asian characters. And that really was on purpose because I was creating the books that I wished that I had had when I was younger. I mean, I said earlier how I pretty much tried to pretend that I wasn't Asian. And as I grew as an adult, and I started thinking about that and why I was so ashamed of that part of my identity, I realized that if I had seen books with characters that look like me in them, it would have made a difference. And so, you know, it's kind of like be the change that you wanted to see. So I guess I kind of took that as my mantra, is like, well, I'm going to make the books then.
And you do make a change, you know, especially when it comes from that personal level, you know, and want and that desire to provide something that you didn't have.
Yes.
You know, when you were a child.
Mm-hmm. Though I do have to admit, I mean, as it is this desire to create books that I didn't have as a child. But, you know, there's this really wonderful side effect of doing that. When I first started creating the books that I make with Asian characters, you know, I kind of was very uncomfortable with that in a weird way. I kind of felt like I was being an imposter. I felt like, because the Asian part of my identity, I didn't really know if I was Asian enough. That was like a really big thing. And I was like, who am I to make these books? I you know, I'm not Asian enough. I can't even speak Chinese well, you know. And are people going to think that I'm, you know, an imposter or I'm faking it, all these things. And it was only through the making of these books for all these years, book after book after book, that I finally feel comfortable and confident with the Asian part of my identity. I really feel like I can claim the Asian part of my Asian Americanness, you know, and that is the gift that my books give me. And perhaps that is really why I make my books, that selfish reason of trying to claim that part of my identity. And maybe it's really the other way around. It's the idea that I was trying to claim the Asian part of my identity, and that's why I make these books. And the side gift is that hopefully it gives kids who didn't see themselves in books what I didn't have. So it can go either way. And I hate to say that perhaps it might be the latter.
It's kind of chicken and egg, you know, because it's like your identity propelled you to create these books too. So I don't know. Why do we do this? You know, we're, you know, so constantly, are we Asian enough? Are we this enough? you are constantly sort of defining yourself because of that lack of role models, perhaps, the lack of conversation about it, the lack of, you know, interaction, you know, especially when you were growing up, that could talk about these issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's that seed of deep insecurity of, especially when you come from, when you have these different identities, like, it's like, who am I, right? Like, so it's like, and you're always kind of insecure about that. And to find that security is kind of a lifelong search.
It really is. I don't think it ever stops.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about your new book before we talk about Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. I really want to hear about Chinese Menu, because when I read about it, it's a collection of 40 stories about legends and tales behind the making of American Chinese food. And I mean, I understand the distinction of what American Chinese food is, but what is the importance of that to you? Just not Chinese food, but American Chinese food.
Okay, so yeah, I'm so glad that you're asking me about this book, because I'm so proud about it, proud of it, and I'm so excited about it. This book, the seed of this book, actually happened all the way back in 2004, after I finished writing and publishing a book called Fortune Cookie Fortunes. And Fortune Cookie Fortunes is just a little story about the family, Asian family, opening up fortune cookies. But in the very back, there's a little kind of end matter, which kind of tells the nonfiction history of fortune cookies. And in that end matter, I did the research and I found out that fortune cookies are not Chinese. In fact, if you go to China, most people don't even know what a fortune cookie is.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
No.
So fortune cookies are a completely Asian American food. And so I remember that I found this out and I was telling this to many of my friends and I said, oh, do you know that fortune cookies aren't really Chinese? And I told them the whole story. And they would always respond like, oh, really? And they'd be kind of like,
there's no such thing in Asia.
Yeah.
You know?
And they'd be like, so yeah, they're not really Chinese? And then, you know, even though I said it myself, the way they said it in kind of this tone of derision and this kind of this tone of like disgust, like, oh, I've been duped. They're not really Chinese. It kind of gave me that weird feeling of like, oh gosh, people could say that about me. Are you really Chinese? And it made me feel kind of bad. And I realized, you know, fortune cookies might be the first Asian American food. And that is not bad. You know, like that's actually kind of cool. And I kind of felt like we should give Asian American foods much more respect. And so that was kind of the seed of this book, the idea that we should give the American Chinese food that we all eat here in the United States every day more respect. I mean, I think there's always been a tone of derision, like, this isn't what they would really eat in China, or like, this isn't really Chinese, you know, like somehow because it's not quote unquote authentic, that it's lesser. And I don't believe that. I mean, I can't believe that, you know.
Well, they don't say that about the hamburger, you know.
And they don't say that about apple pie, you know.
Right, apple pie. Yeah, I mean, you know. Yeah, but there's interesting history. So I hope you went into the history of chop suey, because
yes,
that was the oldest, wasn't it? I mean, with the railroads, you know?
Yes,
yeah, there's no such thing in Asia. When I tell people there's no such thing as chop suey in Asia, there isn't.
Yeah, I have my book is all about not just the histories, but the legends. It's really the legends and the myths behind the story. So chop suey is probably one of the more historical ones, though even that historians like to debate whether or not it's really true.
It's true. How do people actually know, right?
Yes. But it's placed in a historical time. But a lot of the stories that I talk about are like from, you know, way before there were records, right? So, you know, the story of chow mein, the legend of how chow mein was invented was because there was four competing dragons who had this big contest and
it
inspired.
Oh, wow, I haven't heard
that. Yeah, so it inspired someone to create chow mein, you know. And then the story of dumplings, like, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but dumplings are like in the shape of a person's ear. And the reason why they're in the shape of a person's ear is because there is an ancient Chinese doctor who invented dumplings as a medicine to cure people's frostbitten ears. He had like filled it with peppers and warm spices and all these things. And he thought if people ate these dumplings, it would warm them from the inside and cure their frostbitten ears. And of course, I don't really think it cured their frostbitten ears, but people enjoyed the dumplings so much, we just kept eating them. So, you know, it's all these kinds of stories, as well as the more recent ones, like the chop suey story, which I think maybe most of your listeners already know, but I'll try to encapsulate it shortly in a small way, during the gold rush, when a lot of Chinese people came to California, they opened up Chinese restaurants in order to survive, and they always priced their food very cheaply. And the story of chop suey is that there was a bunch of drunk miners who came in late at night and demanded food. And unfortunately, the Chinese chef did not have any supplies to cook these drunk miners any food with, except for what was left over, the scraps. And because he didn't want to anger these drunk miners, he just threw all the scraps together and stir fried them and said, here it is, chop suey.
And voila, chop suey. Yeah, just make up a name and they love it, right? I think that sounds delightful. You must have had a lot of fun putting all these stories together.
Oh, I loved it. It was so much fun. I love this book so much. It might be one of my favorite books. It might be my favorite book of the ones that I've made so far.
Wow, really? More than Where the Mount Meets the Moon?
Well, it's just so different, you know?
Yeah.
It's just so different. It might just be the novelty of it that has made me so enthusiastic. But right now, and that changes every, who knows, next book will be my favorite. But right now, it's like, I'm just so excited about
it. Well, your newest baby is always the one that you fawn over, isn't it? I mean, I don't have children, but that's what I've been told.
You know? And I only have one child, so
there you go.
So
you
go. I can say that without her being like, wait a minute.
Wait a second there. Well, yeah, as I've said, I don't have kids, but when Oregon Children's Theater asked me to direct the stage adaptation of your famous book, Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, I never heard of it, Grace. I have to admit that. I read it, loved it. But every time I told somebody about the play I was directing, I kept hearing from people, I love that book. I love, you know, my child and I, or my mom and I, and, you know, we'd read that and they just love your book. I mean, everywhere it was resounding. Every time I told anybody,
aww.
I mean, it didn't have to be somebody in the arts. It's just, it's out there. It was out there and very beloved. Do you think that's your most famous book, do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably my most well-known book. You know, it was my first book to win a major award. So, because it won the Newbery Honor in 2009. So it's had time to kind of find its way to an audience. But it's really lovely, absolutely lovely to hear that people are still reading it and remembering it. Because, you know, as I said, it did kind of have its heyday in 2009. So to hear that people still are reading it is just really lovely.
No kidding. Yeah, it's stood the test of time for sure.
Yay.
You know, and what I love too are the book locations are based on several journeys you took to Taiwan and China. Did you have the idea for the book before you went on these trips, or when did the inspiration come?
So I've went to Hong Kong and Taiwan, and going to Hong Kong and Taiwan kind of inspired this book, because when I went to Hong Kong and Taiwan as an adult, you know, with kind of new eyes, especially Taiwan with new eyes, I'd see all these things and it would remind me of these fairy tale books that I read when I was younger, these Chinese fairy tale books that my mom kind of sneakily had me read as a child when I was in about third grade. And I kind of started remembering those stories. Like I'd see a statue of a dragon and I'd be like, oh, this is just like that dragon in that story I read in third grade. But like it had been a long time since I'd read those fairy tales. And honestly, those books that my mom had kind of quietly given me were not that well written. They had been just like Chinese stories that had been like plainly translated into English. So they didn't have a lot of details. So I kind of started adding my own details and mixing up the stories, creating my own characters. And that's kind of what became Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. But then after I wrote most of the story, that's when I went to mainland China. And I went to mainland China specifically with the idea of like, what can I see and research here that will help me with my story? And so it was kind of both.
Well, I also love that there's a connection with the locations with what is it pronounced? Shouzhou Garden in China?
Suzhou? Yeah, the Suzhou Garden. Yeah.
Shuzhou yes. Garden.
Yeah.
And Lansu Garden here yes. in Portland. And in fact, I was talking with Grace Lee. I don't know if you remember.
Yes.
She was the executive, the first executive director of Lansu when it was called the Portland Chinese Classical Garden. Mm-hmm. And she said she hosted you about yes. 20 or so years ago at the garden.
Yes. And honestly, I think it was also going to that garden too. Now that you remind me, it was going to that garden that also kind of planted the ideas of Where the Mountain Meets the Moon. So it's kind of a mixture of all these things. I think it was going to the Portland Garden. That kind of was like another like drop in the bucket of the ideas for this book. And I think it was because I went to the Portland Garden, I knew I had to go see the one in Suzhou, which I have to say is pretty much the same. Like it's pretty close.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I thought by going to Suzhou it'd be like something of another level or something like that, which and I think that just goes to show how perfectly created the Lansu Garden is, you know, because I thought I would see a difference, and honestly there really wasn't a huge difference.
I think that they based it on sort of a sister city relationship too. And I just love that, you know, so much of the book, you know, reflects those locations. And we have a personal kind of connection to that in the production as well, to the Lansu Garden, Oregon Children's Theater. I mean, the whole cast, crew, creative team, they're just so thrilled you're coming to Portland. Have you not seen the adaptation by Min Khan before?
I have not. That is why I'm so excited. When he debuted the musical at the Bay Area Children's Theater, I think that's where
it... Yeah, it was. Yeah.
That's when it was quite a while ago. So my daughter was pretty young. I'm not sure how long ago it was, but I remember thinking that I just couldn't travel with my child and yeah. Also, I think financially, I wasn't a very smart move at the time. So there's just a lot of things that were not aligned.
They didn't align.
Yes.
Things didn't align.
And I couldn't force them to align. This time, I was like, I'm going to force it to align. And we're going to go.
That's so wonderful.
And it actually aligned beautifully because it's Memorial Day weekend. You know, it's all these things.
Yeah.
And I was like, this will make it work. And so I'm really, really so glad. You know, and as actually the thing that really pushed me over the edge was I saw on social media all the photos.
I posted a lot of photos,
yeah,
Grace.
But they were wonderful. The photos of the cast in the garden. Yeah, and when I saw the photos of the cast in the garden.
Oh, yes. We did the photo shoot there. Yeah.
It just looked so beautiful. And wow. I said, I have to see this.
Oh, that's so good to hear that it, you know, that it inspired you because, you know, you are the source material. You know? I'm just wondering, speaking of source material, has your book never been optioned for a movie adaptation? I mean, what's going on here? Where's Disney?
Well, I mean, like I said, the book kind of had its heyday in 2009, and that was a much different time, especially in the arts. To be honest, I have a sad story about that.
Oh, no.
So, you know, like I said, this is back in 2009. And when it first won the Newbery Honor, there was kind of a lot of interest for movie options. And so many kind of movie options that my literary agent said, okay, I'm going to partner with a Hollywood agent to field all the options that come in. And the Hollywood agent, I mean, maybe he was not telling me the truth, but he made it seem like everybody's interested. DreamWorks is interested, you know, Fox Animation is interested.
Wow.
And so that's, I mean, who knows? I've learned the hard way that, you know, some people say a lot of things, but it doesn't mean it's real. But,
really? You know. In Hollywood, they just say whatever, you know, and shine you on. I can't believe that.
But he gave me the impression that there was a lot of studios that were interested. Yeah. And so he said, I want to know. So he's like, since there's so many studios that are interested, I want to know the one thing you will not change, the one thing you will not budge on. So, and he's like, I need to know that. Is it the title? Is it like that there's a dragon in it? We can't change the dragon to another animal. What is it that you won't change? And I said, you can't change any of the characters from Asian to Caucasian.
Oh, right. That's pretty basic.
Yeah. He said, oh. And there was kind of this silence, and he said, well, I guess it will have to be animation then. and then it went like, and then all of a sudden it seemed like all the interest died away and dropped away. And it did get optioned by like a very small company who did nothing, and the option has since run out, and there's no so none of my works have been optioned since then. So which is, you know, which in some ways makes me feel sad, but honestly, I tell this to my husband, like, I don't really watch movies. I don't really like watch that much TV. So maybe it's okay. That's not the medium of my heart. It's actually theater and plays and musicals like this that I love. And so the fact that this is a musical now, I mean, that's really what matters. And that's another reason why I felt like I really have to go see it, because this is really the culmination of where I would like it to go.
Well, and maybe that is the saving grace. But, you know, because if it had been optioned by DreamWorks, it would not have been possible to do a stage version. You know, I mean, it wouldn't have had that option. So everything happens for a reason. But, you know, that pain of saying that you want, you know, Asians to play Asian characters and having that be a deficit is really annoying. You know, it's disheartening to hear that.
It's very disheartening. But you have to remember that was all the way back in 2009. And it's amazing to see now. I mean, we still have far to go. Don't get me wrong.
We still have those conversations now, but not as many.
Yeah. I mean, we still have far to go, but it's so nice to know that it wouldn't be such a problem now.
It's not. It, you know, that's why I say, you know, Disney should get on board with something, you know, but I think you're right. You've kept your property, to say the least. And now, you know, there's
a musical.
You know, to see. I'm wondering, you know, I've seen your Facebook presence and your website, and you're very interactive. You talk with schools, book clubs, I mean, educators. Do you get inspired by these conversations that you have? I mean, I know you do a lot of these Zoom kind of visits in the classroom. What is that like for you?
I love it, honestly. It's being an author and an illustrator is a very strange job. It's a wonderful job, but it's a lot of time alone in the studio, and it's a lot of time of like creating something that you love so much and you believe in so much, and you're not really sure after you make it, like, what's happened to it. And so to do these kind of interactive things with book clubs and schools, and to talk to kids who are like, I've read your book, I've loved your book, you know, it means everything to me. Like, it's something that it's not the only reason why I create the books that I do, but it's a big reason why.
Well, I'm wondering, during these talks, do you encourage youth to create their own books too? I would imagine you do.
I do, and I hope that I am encouraging. But I also, it depends on the age. Of course, it also depends on the age of the groups, because I do get a lot of like adults who are looking to break into children's books.
And
I have to break it to them that like, it's a wonderful career, but it's not for the faint of heart, probably much like acting, you know. I think that's the thing that I tell them, is that if you are looking to make it as a career, you have to really want to do it. But to the younger kids, it's not about a career, but it's just about creating something to express yourself. Like I said, it's kind of like what I said about the fact that after doing all these books, I was able to finally claim that part of my identity. It's what creating does for yourself. It makes you a better person. And that's what I try to tell the kids. Not only are you creating something that hopefully makes other people happy, but you're creating, and that makes you a better person too in the creation.
I love that. Creating makes you a better person. That's lovely.
Yeah, because it makes you a more full person, you know?
Yeah.
There's something in the act of creating that you have to become more yourself. And people who are more yourself, more you, are usually happier people.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, if you had any final thoughts you want to leave us with, but that's a pretty good final thought there, unless you have something else you want to add to it.
No, I think that's good.
I love it. Creating makes you a better person. It makes you a fuller person. And, you know, and that's just good for everybody. So, yeah, I like that. Yeah. When did your Chinese menu book come out? Is it already out?
It comes out in September of 2023, so in a couple of months.
Oh, so you're still, yeah, so it's not quite there yet.
Yeah, I'm still in the pre-promotion phase.
Right, pre-promotion. Well, at least people get a head start now in September for Chinese
menu.
Yes,
so people can pre-order and all that stuff.
Pre-order. Author Grace Lin will be in Portland on May 27th at 2 p.m. to see Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, the musical adaptation of her book. And it's at the Newmark Theater in Portland. And she will be doing a special book signing following that performance. It's hosted by Oregon Children's Theater and Green Bean Books. And you actually can order copies ahead of time, I believe, of your books for you to sign, or they might be pre-signed. I don't know.
You know, I think it's for people who can't make that date, but they still want a book signed.
You're so great to sign everything. Hands going to be very tired. Go to octc.org for tickets and more info about that. Grace Lin, it was so beautiful to talk with you today, and I really look forward to your visit in Portland. Is your whole family coming?
Yes, we're all coming.
Oh, that's so delightful. It's wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I hope you'll get to do some visits and go to Lansu again and, you know, just kind of soak it in.
Yes,
it's
I can't wonderful. Wait.
You can find links to gracelin.com and her books on stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. And that's it for Stage and Studio. Till the next conversation, I'm Dee Mae Lo Roberts. We're going out with another song from the OCT production of Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, and it's sung by the very talented cast.
I heard a sound, I looked around, finding all that had been brown was now green. My eyes deceive, are these new leaves?
With the brightest flowers we've ever seen.
Who could bring such fortune to fruitless mountains?
Look up there, is that a pear?
There's a sapling with a very ripe plum.
But we never grow
plums. There's peaches here.
But how? Unclear.
The moss through the year and the sun.
Such blessings.
Change the name to fruitful mountains.